Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland family. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life.
This is Science and Thanksgiving, a special production from The Pulse at WHYY. I'm Mike and Scott. Thanksgiving usually means we're going big, way over the top.
Two turkeys.
My mother insists on bringing additional turkey.
Turkey, like, piled high.
And should that somehow not be enough meat?
Ham.
More side dishes than the table can hold.
Two different stuffings.
Mashed potatoes.
Always fried rice. Always regular rice. Always brown rice.
Green beans, mac and cheese, and of course,
7 different pies.
We travel great distances to see our families and friends. We hug, we eat, we argue, we nap. But now, look at these festivities with the eyes of a scientist. And what you get are questions. Lots of questions.
I've always wondered if turkeys really are as dumb as everyone says they are.
Or wondering
what the psychology behind gratitude was.
What's the science of cranberry bogs?
What happens in our stomachs when we overeat?
On this episode, we're going to look at Thanksgiving under a microscope and answer some of those questions. So let the meal begin. First, we gather around the table and mention a few things we're grateful for. After all, gratitude is supposed to play a starring role on Thanksgiving, feeling thankful, reminding yourself of all that's good in your life. In 2013, Glenn Fox was feeling none of that. He had just lost his mom in the days leading up to Thanksgiving, and he was reeling from the loss.
I remember the day after just going down to get Starbucks and coffee and some pastries, you know, was like the most intense experience ever. And I just thought, how am I even going to get through this? How am I even going to order?
At the time, Glenn was getting his PhD in neuroscience, and he was studying gratitude, of all things, and how this emotion can impact people's health in positive ways. Gratitude has become a bit of a hashtag emotion over the years. We post a picture of our salad and profess to be blessed. But gratitude is a growing area in science. For example, a lot of researchers say expressing it can improve your mental health. So, sitting there with his coffee, Glenn was wondering if gratitude could help him recover from his loss.
You know, I really need to put this into action. Like, I don't want to be flattened by this forever. I don't want this to define me.
He had seen the benefits of gratitude in the lab. But could his research hold up in this real-life situation? Reporter Liz Tung picks up the story from here.
On this Thanksgiving a few years ago, Glenn Fox kept thinking about the last months of his mom's life.
You know, I was very close to my mom. She was a legend.
Stage 4 ovarian cancer had meant surgeries, treatments, hospitalizations, but she still wanted to know all about Glenn's research.
And I told her about all the different things you can do to write down what makes you grateful, to focus on.
Glenn says his mom developed a real practice. She kept a journal, wrote thank you notes, and continued to count her blessings even as things got worse.
She was dying. And yet she would still write down things that she was grateful for. It might be simple things like being able to eat a piece of chocolate, or it might be profound, like a blood transfusion. And she was in tears over the gratitude she felt for the person who'd provided her that blood.
So if gratitude had helped his mom this much during her final months, could it help Glenn cope with his grief? Everything he'd read in grad school seemed to suggest yes.
Grateful people tend to recover faster from trauma and injury. They tend to have better and closer personal relationships and may even just have improved health overall.
All this research had made an impact on Glenn. He says gratitude was sort of part of his overall mindset. But what he'd never done was this thing that all the studies recommend, gratitude journaling.
I don't think I really knew the extent to which gratitude could work when you actually wrote things down.
Glenn started his gratitude journal in 2014. I asked him to read me some of his early entries.
There's some funny ones in here, like
tacos on the sidewalk and didn't drink too much.
He's got a lot of entries like that.
Oh, I made a cutting board and it said cutting board is holding up very well.
It seemed almost silly writing this stuff down. Could it really help Glenn get better, get over his deep grief? To answer that question, we have to take a closer look at the emotion of gratitude itself. For that, I turn to Emiliana Simon-Thomas. She heads Berkeley's Greater Good Science Center, and she says gratitude, at least in the way it functions, is basically a social emotion.
And it creates this bond, this enduring sense of connection with another person.
It's an emotion that rewards cooperation between humans. And of course, that is essential for our survival as a species.
That's what it's for. And humans have it from an very early time as a way to create these social relationships that are so important for our evolutionary success.
Emiliana says gratitude is also tied to other emotions that connect humans.
Gratitude scaffolds other emotional experiences.
For instance, love.
There's certainly a relationship between gratitude and interpersonal trust.
So gratitude supports our relationships, supports the feelings that bind us together. And like Glenn said, studies have shown it offers plenty of benefits. It can make us happier and more resilient. In some studies, it's even been shown to improve our immune systems, blood pressure, and heart function. So the big question that Glenn and other researchers have been trying to figure out is why? What is it about gratitude that could be leading to this whole host of positive benefits? To find out, Glenn did an experiment where they put subjects in fMRI machines and mapped which circuits in the brain were activated when they felt grateful.
So we saw that the participants' ratings of gratitude correlated with activity in a set of brain regions associated with interpersonal bonding and with relief from stress.
This is where Glenn thinks the benefit lies. For one thing, you've got the rewarding feeling of social interaction. The regions associated with gratitude are part of the larger networks that are involved when we socialize and experience pleasure. They also happen to be connected with stress relief.
You know, that feeling of relief is itself quite rewarding. We call that reward from relief.
Which feels good and is good for us. Because as it turns out, stress is super toxic.
And so anything we can do to relieve stress will probably lead to health benefits somewhere along the line.
Specifically, stress relief has been shown to reduce pain, physical and emotional, which of course is exactly what Glenn wanted.
So in 2014, the year after his mom's death, Glenn decided to try and find relief in gratitude journaling.
At first, the entries were pretty mundane.
Let's see, night out with friends, woke up early, foot feels better, good lunch, free hotel room, good day ahead, chance to be productive. Like easy commute comes up a lot. If I had a nice easy drive where I was able to maintain my composure driving through Los Angeles, pretty short entries, so not super profound here.
Glenn kept with it. But he says the entries didn't really change the way he felt, at least not at first.
And it wasn't that gratitude made me feel good about it. It didn't make me feel like, oh, everything is great. Because gratitude isn't a synonym for happiness. What gratitude got me in that moment wasn't that I didn't feel any pain. Far from it. In fact, it may have even made that sense of pain more acute, but it made me aware of it in a way that I felt I could manage it.
So if gratitude wasn't delivering a quick hit of relief, how exactly was it helping? Josh Brown at Indiana University Bloomington looked into this. He says the benefits of gratitude build up over time. He knows this from a study they did in which they had subjects write letters of gratitude. Then they did brain scans and tracked their subjects' mental health. What they found was that the practice of writing these letters seemed to actually rewire their brains, making their gratitude centers more active over time.
Okay, so what does that mean? It seems that the act of expressing gratitude caused a long-lasting change in the sensitivity of the brain to gratitude. That, to me, is one of the most striking results of what we did. And so it seems that the act of expressing gratitude can have these remarkably lasting changes on the brain.
Now, we can't say for sure that one thing led to the other, but we do know that in studies, gratitude has been correlated with improved mental health. And it appears, based on this study, that gratitude exercises increase our ability to feel gratitude in the first place.
Here again is Glenn Fox.
I think that gratitude can be much more like a muscle, like a trained response or a skill that we can develop over time as we learn to recognize abundance and gifts and things that we didn't previously notice as being important.
Glenn says this doesn't mean that you're just falling over with gratitude all the time. It means you become more attuned to the full range of gratitude, whether somebody's holding a door for you or giving you a kidney.
We actually increase our resolution of gratitude, meaning we see it in high fidelity. It's like HD gratitude.
It's something Glenn sees in his own gratitude journaling when he compares his entries from 5 years ago to his entries now.
So I'm looking here at the more recent ones are much more specific. A brisk spring morning walk and a new book. Sunshine through the windows during meditation. Let's see, warm sun at the pond. My new niece giggling during our trip to North Carolina. They're not necessarily getting even super long or elaborate, but they're much more specific. And I think that's really where you get the HD gratitude from, is the practice of seeing and looking for those small things that you can count on to feel better about what you have.
Glenn emphasizes that none of this has been a magic bullet. It didn't save him from the grief of losing his mother or the daily frustrations of LA traffic or things like breaking his foot. But slowly, over time, it's made a difference.
You know, it's like water cutting rock through a canyon. It's not done all at once, and it's just steady practice. And it's not meant to make sure you never feel pain again. I really think that's one of the things. And especially with gratitude, where people just think, oh, I'll just wait, and then I'll just, if something bad happens, I'll just find a way to be grateful, and that'll make the pain go away. And I think you shift your perspective to sort of being grateful for the pain, grateful for the chance to have a sense of putting the pain in perspective. And that to me is a skill. And that's why the journaling has been so important.
That story was reported by Liz Tong. You're listening to Science and Thanksgiving. We're looking at this national holiday through a scientific lens. If gratitude is the starring emotion at Thanksgiving, turkey is the starring dish. We seem divided on the taste of this bird, from delicious to dry and bland. But that aside, many people seem to think that turkeys are really dumb. Is that true? Reporter Alan Yu went to a farm to find out.
I'm at a farm an hour outside of Philadelphia to talk turkey with Axel Lindy. He's been raising turkeys for the past 12 years. And yes, customers do ask him if turkeys are dumb.
You'll never see a turkey in a circus because they're not trainable that way.
But his 30-odd white domesticated turkeys can learn patterns. For example, they know that Axel plus bucket means feeding time.
We tried to start them out training them by bringing the same buckets out all the time. They recognize the buckets. When we go out to the pasture with our pickup trucks, they recognize the truck and they come right to it.
And you don't need to train all of them. The turkeys stay together in a flock and learn from each other.
One of them will figure out where the water is and then the rest follow. If one of them finds a hole in the fence, then they all find it.
I think they're following us.
Axel says turkeys might have gotten their reputation as dummies because of one specific behavior. When it rains, some turkeys look up at the sky with their beaks open. Here is retired animal sciences professor Tom Savage.
I think it was the Reader's Digest, I'm not completely sure. There would be articles in there, and there would little small captions that say, turkeys are dumb. Quote, they will stand out in a field, look up straight while it's raining, and drown. That is inaccurate.
Tom is very passionate about righting that wrong. He has studied and raised turkeys for years. He says turkeys do not drown because they look up at the sky. And this funny-looking posture is the result of a disorder.
What we found was that this was a genetic disorder, what we called tetanic torticollis spasms, aka stargazing.
And it's not permanent. The birds with this condition will put their heads back down after about a minute. Now, these are domesticated turkeys. Wild ones are a little different. Mary Jo Casalina is the wild turkey biologist with the Pennsylvania Game Commission. She has hunted wild turkeys for years.
They're extremely witty and they're extremely wary of their surroundings.
For example, they react much quicker than humans do.
We kind of like are moving in slow motion as far as what a turkey would perceive.
She says around 13 years ago, she was watching a wild turkey perfectly still in the bushes and camouflaged, gun at the ready, but it turned its head, spotted her, and ran away. She says that wild turkey saw her because they can see light spectrum that humans can't. In fact, their eyesight is so good that she has to use a different laundry detergent for her hunting clothes.
I realized that the laundry detergent that I was using, my clothes were emitting ultraviolet light.
Now, some people might say that's just instinct and does not address the matter of intelligence. We can judge animal cognition in a variety of ways, whether animals can use tools, solve problems, find food that they've buried, and so on. But Joa Madden says whether turkeys are dumb is not the right question to ask. He's an associate professor of animal behavior at the University of Exeter in the UK. Instead, he says what we should ask is whether turkeys are smart enough to survive and reproduce in their surroundings.
It's a common trap in evolutionary studies to ask, why can't they do X?
Judging animals by a human measure of intelligence makes about as much sense as asking why sharks can't fly. Intelligence matters for humans, but for other animals, it doesn't play the same role. Joa studies pheasants, which are in the same family of birds as turkeys. He recently found that learning quickly could even be a disadvantage in some circumstances. He set up what he calls a reverse learning task. Pheasant chicks learned that pecking into a blue bin gets them a nice worm. A green bin gets them nothing. After a while, he reversed the two. Now green bins have worms and blue bins don't. Some pheasants quickly realized the bins had changed. Others took longer. Then Joa released them into the wild to deal with foxes and birds of prey. You might think the birds that picked up on the change sooner are smarter.
What we found was that the birds that were most likely to survive were actually those who were slowest to reverse things. So instead of being incredibly flexible in their learning abilities, they seemed to learn one thing and stick to it.
So the birds that us humans would call smarter were less likely to survive in the wild. And in the end, survival is what matters.
That was Alan Yu reporting. Cranberries have to be on the table for Thanksgiving, right? No matter how you feel about them.
It just is there. I just show up at my Aunt Peggy's house and it's just like in a dish.
I like cranberries. I prefer cranberry sauce when it's not like, you know, the little fruits in it. I like it to be like smooth. It's good.
It's gross.
The canned cranberry sauce, I can't stand. But like homemade cranberry sauce is really good.
So how do these berries make their way to our tables? You've probably seen those cranberry commercials where two farmers wearing waders stand waist deep in a sea of red berries.
Ah, refreshing.
Ocean Spray Cran Lemonade.
During harvest, farmers flood their bogs and the berries float to the top. So growing cranberries requires clever engineering, but also a very special type of environment and a lot of water. Growers have to walk a careful line between keeping production up and keeping their land healthy. Steph Yin reports from the New Jersey Pine Barrens, where cranberry growing is a multi-generational tradition for many families.
The Pine Barrens are a spread of dense coastal forest in South Jersey, a million acres, stretching over more than a fifth of the state. Here, you'll find a history of outlaws and smugglers, and many a ghost story. From sandy, acidic soil, which locals call sugar sand, sprout rare orchids, carnivorous plants, and pygmy pitch pines, with twisted branches and multiple trunks per tree. Rivers and streams flow with what looks like tea, the water dyed reddish-brown from cedar trees. This is home to a rich agricultural community, too. Commercial cranberry farming started here in the mid-1800s. The farmers bought large tracts of land for cheap, started cultivating the berries that were growing there naturally. They consider themselves stewards of a rare and remarkable ecosystem.
We look at cranberries as part of a larger system around the bogs.
That's Steve Lee, a fifth-generation Pine Barrens cranberry farmer. He says cranberries grow wild all over here. Canoe down any local river, and you might be able to collect the fruit right off the riverbed.
They belong in wetlands. If you find a cranberry vine growing in the New Jersey Pinelands, by definition, you are in a wetland. And we've learned to live in harmony with the wetlands.
A large part of that has to do with water. It's a popular misconception that cranberry bogs are always underwater. But it's true that water is important, crucial really, to cranberry farming. It's hard to pick cranberries from vines on the ground. So to make harvest easier, most cranberry growers flood their bogs in the fall. The berries float to the surface. Then growers use harvesting machines called egg beaters to knock them off the vine. In the winter, the bogs are flooded again. This time, the water insulates the plants from frost. Underlying the Pine Barrens is a natural aquifer, 17 trillion gallons of bacterially sterile, sand-filtered water that scientists have compared to melted glacial ice.
So we got a floodgate here.
The farmers here divert water from nearby streams and rivers to flood their bogs. It's an interconnected system that allows them to share and cycle water between one another.
Like we have our neighbors to the north, the Lees, and our neighbors to the south, the Suis. We got to work with them. Like, hey, I'm sending some water your way. Hey, we need some water.
That's Mike Haynes. He and his sister Steph are giving me a tour of their farm.
Like a new bog. We renovated a couple years
Mike
ago.
And Steph are fifth generation growers, and they help run their family business, the Pine Island Cranberry Company. They sell their cranberries through Ocean Spray, which is a private co-op of some 700 cranberry farms. Ocean Spray dominates the U.S. market. The co-op takes berries grown by farmers, markets them, and processes them into products like juice, craisins, or the cranberry sauce you might be having for Thanksgiving. Steph says water is central to their operation.
If we do not have a clean, abundant water supply, then we don't get anywhere.
Their grandfather built the family business accordingly.
He was the one who understood the importance of farming for not him, not for himself, not for his generation, not even for the next generation, but like for my generation. A lot of what we're doing now is built upon what he was doing back in the 40s and 50s.
To ensure clean water, you need to control a lot of land. In the Pinelands, growers follow this general rule of thumb. For every 1 acre of producing cranberry bog, they maintain 9 acres of supporting woodland to protect the watershed. But cranberry farming can pose a major threat to waterways because of pesticide and fertilizer runoff. Think of the settings cranberries thrive in. Moist, swampy. It's the kind of situation insects, fungi, parasites, and weeds love. The vast majority of farms use a range of synthetic chemicals, which get discharged into local water bodies and can be harmful. And it doesn't help that regulation is murky. A legal loophole makes runoff from cranberry bogs exempt from the Federal Clean Water Act. The New Jersey farmers say they use fertilizers sparingly.
It's not a hit or miss. It's very calculated.
But in reducing pesticides, farmers have to keep a watchful eye on one specific pest.
The blunt-nosed leafhopper.
Leafhopper.
A leafhopper.
The leafhopper.
Called the blunt-nosed leafhopper.
The blunt-nosed leafhopper. It transmits a phytoplasma, or bacteria, that causes something called false blossom disease. In the 1920s and 30s, that disease nearly eradicated cranberry farming in New Jersey. Over the last decade, farmers and researchers have noticed that leafhoppers are starting to return. Just down the road from Steve Lee's and Stephen Mike Haynes' farms is the Rutgers University Marucci Center for Blueberry and Cranberry Research.
Hi. How are you?
Good.
I tried to drive into the forest.
Here, researchers like Cesar Rodriguez Sauna are trying to find ways to fight back in a sustainable way.
So here we have plants that are infected and non-infected.
Cesar is looking for alternatives to chemicals. That might be boosting the natural defenses plants have, or encouraging populations of natural enemies, predators of cranberry pests. For instance,
parasitic wasps that attack the eggs of leafhoppers.
Researchers are also trying to figure out how and if ecosystems bounce back after years of cranberry growing. My last stop is to a former bog with Ped Deneshgar, an ecologist at Monmouth University in New Jersey. I'm here with him and other members of his lab, and we're trying to find a trace of what once was.
I'm trying to see if I can find a surviving cranberry.
Do you think there is one?
Well, we found some last time.
Really?
Yeah. You just see them. They're usually really little. They more look more like how they...
If you didn't know this was once a thriving cranberry bog, you wouldn't guess it. It feels like a wild ecosystem. We're surrounded by trees, some as tall as 30 or 40 feet. There's a layer of pine needles underfoot. Overhead, blue jays are calling, trying to shoo us from their territory.
Blue jays are not thrilled with us being
territorial.
Ped says half a century ago, instead of trees, cranberry vines covered this area. Visiting abandoned bogs across the Pinelands, he found it doesn't take long for these sites to unravel back into a wild state. Together, we go to a bog that's been neglected for just a few years. Already, there are saplings and woody shrubs sprouting up.
Little baby red maples like that. Usually those are spot treated with herbicide to get rid of them.
So this is maple.
Yep, and then they transition to that. And they like wet soil, so they're part of like the process of transitioning back to a forest system.
Cranberry bogs swiftly returning to nature, decades of heavy agriculture forgiven. This isn't really what I was expecting to find. I asked Ped about it.
I started this with the idea that we were going to find some really scary things.
Instead, Ped was surprised to find that the effects of intensive cranberry agriculture seemed minimal, at least with some time. But, he says, while nature seems robust here, it's still crucial to pay attention to the immediate short-term impacts of cranberry farming.
I think it's more of a testament of the Pinelands just being very resilient.
That story was reported by Steph Yin. You're listening to Science and Thanksgiving. I'm Mike and Scott. Our digestive system works overtime on Thanksgiving. The moment you start smelling the food, it is kicking into gear.
It is. That turkey in the oven you're smelling is just playing with your emotions and playing with your digestive system. That's where we start to increase saliva production.
That's Earl Campbell III. He is a gastroenterologist at Yale University.
Once the food actually enters our mouth and we are chewing the food, saliva helps to break down the food. We then swallow the food, and some people will say that swallowing, and it's true, up until defecation is the last voluntary component of digestion.
So once you swallow, there's no going back. The food moves through the esophagus.
Like almost as if someone's squeezing toothpaste out of a tube.
Into the stomach.
The stomach crushes the food. And mixes also secretes acid that helps to break down the food. By the time the food leaves the stomach, it's a paste-like material, and it's passed into the small intestines.
From there, the food breaks down even more. Nutrients are absorbed all along the way until it exits the body. But on Thanksgiving, we eat way more than usual. So what happens when we overeat? How does this affect the process that you just laid out for us?
Yeah, so the stomach, you know, that muscular bag, it can, on average, hold about a liter, but it can expand, it can stretch up to about 4 liters.
That's bigger than a gallon jug of milk. Imagine that, filled with mashed potatoes and gravy sloshing around inside of you, pressing up against your organs. Wow, it can really blow up like a balloon then. And that's not good, probably.
It's there to help us out, but, you know, we don't need to necessarily push our stomach to the limits, especially on a, you know, regular basis. And, you know, we can on days like Thanksgiving, but we will pay the price in terms of, you know, we will feel uncomfortable. You know, our body has to work harder. And you may feel a little bit tired after your meal or sluggish because your body's then directing a lot of that energy just into trying to break down that meal.
What about sometimes when I've really overdone it in terms of food, my heart is racing. I'm just feeling like, whoa,
I'm running, but I'm not. I'm just laying on the couch, you know? Why is your heart beating more?
So that's a part of the body revving up the metabolism. Your gut needs more blood flow, needs more oxygen to supply the gut so that it can absorb and so that the stomach can break down. So your heart has to increase its production to help out the digestive tract.
Why do we overeat so much? It seems like sometimes we keep eating and eating, and then suddenly it's like, oh no, now I've way overdone it. But we don't know it until it's too late.
Our body secretes different hormones that makes us either feel full or makes us hungry. And so there's a fine balance between those hormones. The hormones that make us hungry, those don't drop to its lowest point until about 30 to 60 minutes after a meal. And the hormones that make us feel full and satisfied, those don't peak until about 30 to 60 minutes after our meal. So it's very easy for us to eat a meal and actually have a full stomach, but not yet feel full.
What helps with this? I mean, sometimes I feel like we go through the meal pretty quickly. You spend hours cooking it, but then we're done eating in like half an hour. So does slowing down help?
Definitely. One of the things I'd strongly advise is just taking our time and chewing our food. And, you know, the longer we're taking to chew and eat our food, you know, we're pacing ourselves. And then, you know, that gives your body time to let you know that it's full. After you finish eating, you know, probably sit around and wait 20 to 30 minutes and just ask yourself, you know, am I still hungry? Rather than just going immediately back for more after you finish.
Earl Campbell III is a gastroenterologist at Yale University. You're listening to Science and Thanksgiving. I'm Mike and Scott. Even if you go back for seconds or thirds, leftovers are basically unavoidable on Thanksgiving, and lots of them. That once delicious, now aging casserole will stare back at you until December, unless you throw it away. A lot of the abundance of Thanksgiving ends up in the trash, but food waste is a year-round problem. Jad Slaman looked into how and why we waste so much food and how some people are trying to stop this problem.
Amy McCormick calls her daughters downstairs.
Hey, girls, grab your shoes. We're going to do a quickie quick.
It's time to get groceries. Mom, Dad, and twin girls climb into the car. I follow to an Aldi supermarket a few miles away in Burlington, New Jersey. The family pull right past the parking lot and stop around back.
And the family piles out.
You have made it to our favorite dumpster.
For the McCormicks, virtually all their grocery shopping happens behind the grocery store, in whatever dumpster isn't locked.
These are the tools of the trade here, though.
Yeah, this is a gaff, fishing gaff for big things like gallons of milk. Or big bags so you can grab the handle.
That's Dad, Dwayne McCormick. He's got a little step stool he climbs up on. Amy has one of those long grabber arms.
I mean, honestly, it doesn't smell that bad.
No. Dwayne sees some familiar blue packaging.
Does this hang?
Oh my God, tell me this isn't, like, this is the way the universe works.
Ice cream sandwiches.
Ice cream sandwiches.
It's hard to find solid ice cream. Dwayne's one complaint about dumpster inventory.
I'm halfway tempted.
I know.
You know,
that's why
I think,
tempted you. That's why I think I am.
As he turns the box, some cream, no longer iced, dribbles out.
No, I'm not. Okay.
No.
I do. Amy moves some bags with her grabber, and some produce rolls around.
Those are like the worst looking peaches I've ever seen.
Yeah.
She uses her grabber to open a tied up black trash bag. And pay dirt.
There's some good stuff in here. We have sweet potato chips. We have a loaf of bread, another loaf of bread. There's margarine.
It all looks and smells like it's in perfect condition. We've started really shopping when all of a sudden.
Leave you guys to leave.
Oh, I'm sorry. What?
What was that?
It's a store employee. She's got more trash to toss, and we're in the way. She says she can call the cops. Amy tells the employee it's not illegal, but they leave anyway. Duane says these confrontations are rare and nothing new, but still, they sort of sting.
I could just tell they were judging me, saying, "What are you doing in my trash?" For a brief second, I guess you think, "What am I doing in someone else's trash?" I don't know. Because I am there doing that, the dumpster diving, I'm now lower socially.
It bothers Amy considerably less.
Yeah, but who cares?
They're a well-off, well-educated, middle-aged couple with young kids. The dumpster diving, for them, is about avoiding food waste. I wanted to meet them because they buck a very un-Thanksgiving food reality. Abundance and waste go hand in hand. Brian Lipinski broke it down for me.
I am a food waste analyst with the World Resources Institute.
Globally speaking, he says about a third of all food produced is never eaten for different reasons. In the developing world,
places like Sub-Saharan Africa, South and Southeast Asia,
it's because of what's called food loss. Pests eat crops in the field, harvest spoils in transit. Basically, product never even makes it to the market. But in the developed world,
as incomes rise, you see it start shifting towards the downstream retail and consumer levels.
To what's called food waste. It was grown and harvested or raised and butchered. It was processed, packaged, and shipped, all without a hitch. Made it to our stores and kitchens, but ultimately it was thrown away. In fact, 43% of all waste, the lion's share, happens in our own homes.
It's much more about human behavior. That's actually pretty challenging because getting people to change the way they behave is very difficult.
This worries Brian because globally, the middle class is growing and quickly. The world's poorest are getting richer, and that's great, but there's a chance their relationship to food will end up eventually like ours, wasteful. We'll be producing more food than ever and also throwing away more than ever.
You need land to grow all that food, and right now we're already maxing out on the amount of agricultural land we can have on the planet without, you know, just completely demolishing our atmosphere with greenhouse gases.
So how did we become so wasteful? Brian Rowe, an economist with Ohio State University's Food Waste Collaborative, says it starts with President Lincoln.
Lincoln's major advancements in kind of the agricultural sector, developing land grant universities, developing the extension service that really ramped up the transfer of technology from universities to the general population.
Lincoln signed into law a bill creating our Department of Agriculture. In the 20th century, Rowe says public outrage at food production scandals and two world wars forced advancements in preservation and packaging. We got better at growing food, better at keeping it fresh, so it got cheaper.
It's simple economics. When you have a lot of something, typically the price is going to be low, and we're not quite as vigilant about wasting things that are inexpensive or cheap, and we are blessed with an abundance of food.
There's an argument for easing agriculture subsidies, producing less surplus, essentially making food cost what it truly costs, especially in terms of environmental damage. But then...
Yeah, and then you exacerbate the issue on that 1 in 7 food insecure in the country that... are hoping that food prices will stay low and go even a little bit lower.
Amid all this waste, there are Americans going to bed hungry every night. So human behavior it is. Experts say it's on us as individuals. But it's complicated. Mia Baru, a marketing researcher at the Catholic University in Lyon, France, says public awareness campaigns can actually backfire.
First, if we just tell people how much they waste, so most of them said, oh, 1/3 of the food is wasted, then we may think 1/3 of the food, that's a lot. So if everybody's doing it, but for sure I'm not wasting that much. So that sort of makes you feel good about yourself and you just think that you're not wasting that much.
Research, though, also shows people vastly underestimate how much food they actually waste. And even if they do own up to it,
people feel bad. If we keep on blaming them, at some point we're just gonna be so tired of feeling bad that we're just not gonna think about it anymore.
Folks just tune it out. But just to make a point about blame, all the experts I talked to mentioned there's a great deal working against the average person looking to waste less. There's arbitrary sell-by dates, bulk item marketing. Mia tells me even the size of our fridges makes it easy to just toss stuff in there and forget about it. She purposely keeps her fridge nearly empty.
So what's in your fridge right now?
Wine, some cheese, and yogurt.
So what could work? Brian Rowe, the economist, tells me some cities like Seoul, South Korea, actually tax household food waste.
Food waste and other organics have a separate disposal, and you have to pay basically by the pound to dispose of that.
Or, he says, increase the cost of food while also increasing food assistance for the poor, things like SNAP. Mia's solution is less grandiose. Just be positive.
Positive. You can do it. You can change it. You're good at it. Look how good others are doing. Of course, you can do it too.
Get people excited about saving food. I was pretty skeptical hearing that, but then, I mean, just listen to Dwayne and Amy saving groceries from the trash.
Oh my god.
Ice cream sandwiches.
When's the last time you were that excited on grocery day? On any day? If only the rest of us could look at leftover turkey and stuffing the same way Dwayne looks at melting ice cream in a dumpster. For The Pulse, I'm Jad Slaman.
Coming up, the love and bonds that keep so many of us coming home for Thanksgiving.
There was a sense of duty that I felt to, like, be in this place at this time.
That's next.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Science and Thanksgiving, a special production from The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. When we gather around the Thanksgiving table, especially when we live far away from our families, the passage of time often becomes visible. New family members take their spot in their little baby seats, getting their first taste of mashed potatoes. Empty chairs mark the absence of those who are no longer with us. It's a chance to remember things we've been through, to tell stories, and to celebrate what we have in this moment. Reporter Nina Feldman meets up with a group of friends every year at this time. They all come home for Thanksgiving, and this gathering holds a special importance to them.
There were six of us who went to high school together. We met at Community High, a small public school in Ann Arbor, Michigan. It has a reputation as a place for freaks, artists, and kids who don't want a traditional education. There are no bells, teachers go by their first names, and students can pitch their own classes and earn credit from experts outside of school. Anywhere else, my friends and I would have been considered misfits, even rebellious. But in a school of 500 weirdos, we bonded over being kind of normal. We did most of that bonding in my friend Marie's garage.
We had like a TV out there and a little mini fridge, and it was just like a hangout area.
That's Marie. The garage stood alone, just feet from her parents' house, and it was a win-win. Our parents liked it because they felt like we were technically under supervision. We liked it because we felt like we technically weren't.
We could be, like, louder and, you know, smoke more weed in there than we would have been able to if it had been actually in their home.
We spent hours in there. We drank a lot of rum and coke for some reason, danced, developed crushes, argued, changed our minds. We tried on different personalities, used each other as sounding boards, and became the people we are today.
I got grounded once because you were a part of this.
This is Anna, another friend from the group.
I told my parents I was living at your house when we went to a party at Lisa's sister's house. But then I wasn't allowed to sleep over anywhere for like a month and a half. And I just remember like melting down and telling my parents that they were ruining my life. Because if I missed a moment, then I missed everything.
It's true. We really spent all our time together. After high school, most of us left town for college. We'd come home for Thanksgiving break like lots of kids do. We'd go out the night before Thanksgiving, meet up with old classmates. A lot of times we'd end up in this dark, crowded basement bar downtown Ann Arbor called Babs. It was sloppy and fun. But after a few years, it started to get old.
Here's another buddy of mine, Jake.
I just remember being down there and like that was sort of the cutoff where like the next year we were like, everyone's going to Babs, but what if we just didn't go to Babs? Like, what if we just didn't do that?
I think that's the point when a lot of people lose contact with their friends from growing up. High school slips into a bygone era. People get more serious partners and jobs. It's expensive to travel at Thanksgiving. You miss a year, maybe it becomes a pattern. We could have fizzled out. But then Ethan died. Ethan was one of our crew. He was brilliant and adventurous and an amazing cuddler. He died in a rock climbing accident when he was 28 in October of 2015. I was the first to find out. My mom called me while I was still in bed on a Saturday morning. I remember yelling no over and over again as she told me what had happened. And then I started calling my friends. A month after Ethan died, we all came home for Thanksgiving. This time, it mattered more than ever.
There was a sense of duty that I felt to, like, be in this place at this time because, like, our group of friends, like, needed to solidify the bond, and that, and in solidifying, it was like holding tight to the memory of Ethan.
If there had ever been any doubt that we would keep coming home, there wasn't anymore.
We're not going to voluntarily lose someone else. No, no, no.
That Thanksgiving after he died, we definitely didn't want to go out to the bars. Luckily, right around that time, our friend Steve opened up a restaurant in Ann Arbor. It's called Spencer. That first year, our get-together was somber. It was a time for us to grieve together. But every year since, it's been joyful.
Now, every time we go back on that Wednesday, I mean, we just all go straight to Spencer. It's like our little clubhouse when we get home, especially on the night before Thanksgiving, because they're closed. And so he opens it up for us and, you know, someone walks in and give them a big hug and pour them a glass of wine.
Oh my God. I've never tasted anything better.
Coming home at this time of year acts as an anchor. It's not just being home, and it's not just being together. It's the combination. Here's Marie again.
I think it feels sometimes to me like it provides a reset. Like, it allows me to relax, to like, I don't know, like let go of stuff in a way that like other places don't.
I have this image of getting older, where we're just adding layers onto our personalities over the years. The selves we had when we were 15 are still buried down there. They're just obscured by all the life we've piled on top. Places we've been, tragedies we've weathered. When I go home each year for Thanksgiving, I can access the person I was when I was 15. Around my friends, I really feel like that kid in the garage deciding who I want to be. But I'm also the 31-year-old at Spencer, who has already decided.
That was Nina Feldman reporting. Science and Thanksgiving was produced by The Pulse at WHYY in Philadelphia. You can catch The Pulse every week wherever you get your podcasts. Our health and science reporters are Alan Yu, Liz Tung, Jad Slayman, and Steph Yin. Our intern is Grant Hill. We had production assistance from Julian Harris. Charlie Kyer is our engineer. Lindsay Lazarski is our producer. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening, and happy Thanksgiving.
Behavioral Health Reporting on The Pulse is supported by the Thomas Scattergood Behavioral Health Foundation, an organization that is committed to thinking, doing, and supporting innovative approaches in integrated healthcare. WHYY's Health and Science Reporting is supported by a generous grant from the Public Health Management Corporation's Public Health Fund. PHMC gladly supports WHYY and its commitment to the production of services that improve our quality of life.